a couple of general comments to begin with. I attended the Memorial Day service at St. Paul's this morning to commemorate those American soldiers who fought and died, many of them on behalf of protecting New Zealand in the Second World War. Quite an emotional time, of course, for me personally, with the loss of my nephew some years ago. This evening I'm attending a farewell to John Whitehead as Secretary of Treasury, and I'd like to compliment John Whitehead as a very professional, decent person who has fulfilled his role to the highest standards. I was listening to John Whitehead's interview on Sunday and found a number of his comments very interesting. The comments about the importance of paying off the debt over the last 10 years, which has given New Zealand a buffer. His talk about the need to upskill New Zealand in order to get growth into the economy, which was very much a theme of my speech at the Congress. But perhaps most interestingly were the comments that John Whitehead made about New Zealand being the seventh most unequal country in the developed world, and the consequences of that for New Zealanders, the fact that an unequal society does not create the social conditions for everybody to achieve to their potential and contribute to their potential. I think that's very important, most interesting coming from the Secretary of Treasury, which is why Labor's talking about things like lifting the minimum wage and a fairer tax system.
Do you think that, I mean, Dalglish has said that the last two budgets haven't done anything to narrow that gap at all. So effectively, the head of the Treasury is saying that he's failed in that regard.
Well, I think it's worse than not having done anything to lessen the inequality. Actually, the inequality has grown hugely because the big tax cuts made the people at the top very much better off, and the people at the bottom are finding it harder than ever. The people at the bottom were the ones that didn't get the big tax cuts, haven't had a salary increase, and are finding it really hard to meet the growing cost of living.
This budget, though, when we look at the polling on it, and there's been a number of polls, you said it was the worst budget in 27 years, yet voters seem to think that National's done a reasonable job of it because they're still supporting National.
Well, I think the budget was a failed budget because it had no plan to get out of the hole that we're in. You know, cut, sell, borrow and hope is not a plan. What we wanted to see from the government was a plan of how to grow the economy, you know, maybe through research and development, maybe through upskilling, a change in taxation policies to help the export economy, something else that John Whitehead referred to. The public have clearly understood that a $16.7 billion deficit is not sustainable. That's a deficit that this government has built up. But we have ideas of how we can get that deficit down. Yes, there will have to be sacrifice by New Zealanders, but fairly and proportionately. But also, you've got to have a plan for growth, and that's what was lacking in the budget.
Why do you think that it doesn't resonate with the public, your attack on the budget? Clearly, they're relatively satisfied with it.
Well, that's not what I'm finding on the ground. I did three or four quite big meetings last week. Every one of those meetings were overwhelmingly, a majority of people were against asset sales. People don't want to see their New Zealand-owned, Kiwi-owned community assets sold off. I think that is still an Achilles heel for the government, and at the end of the year, New Zealanders will have a clear choice on that.
Do you think New Zealanders accept, though, the cuts to KiwiSave, largely?
I think those that aren't in KiwiSaver won't be so concerned about it, but certainly those that are have shown incredible concern to me. There was a family that I was talking to on the weekend where they nominated KiwiSaver as an example of betrayal, that the government had promised them one thing and they'd shifted the goalpost. And I think that a lot of New Zealanders are feeling that, and in 5 weeks' time when that bites in, people will be even more angry about it.
Would it surprise you, we've got a poll tonight, would it surprise you to learn that it's pretty split, the opinion on those cuts? A lot of people say they actually accept it because they were in debt as a country.
Well, if you're not in KiwiSaver, you'll probably accept the fact that KiwiSaver has been cut. But for those that are in it, they see this as bad faith. They see it as undermining trust and confidence in the scheme. And my big concern is actually that a future generation of people that might go into KiwiSaver will be warned off it because they will not trust the government not to change it again.
Are you concerned where Labor is at the polls at the moment?
Well, look, we're sitting pretty consistently on over a third of New Zealanders supporting us, about 34%. It's not good enough yet, but it is a solid base to build on. If we can build that by another 5 or 6%, we can lead a coalition government at the end of this year.
If this is the worst budget in 27 years, why hasn't National dropped more and Labor picked up more?
I think because in the first flush of the budget announcements, people see a huge debt, and they know something has to be done about that. That doesn't mean to say that they are comfortable with the solutions that National has adopted. And I think as we focus the public's attention on those areas like asset sales, betrayal of promises over KiwiSaver, we'll see people voting on those issues at the election, and that's our intention.
Just in respect of asset sales, do you accept, given that the government has rightly or wrongly banked the $5 to $7 billion that they believe that they'll get from the partial sell down, does that make your promise not to sell assets a $5 to $7 billion promise?
Well, you've got to look at the sale of assets as to whether that will actually help the debt problem. In the short term, yes, you'll pay off maybe $5 billion. In the longer term, you've lost those assets forever and the dividends that went with it. So economically, it actually doesn't make sense to do that. That's why we won't be.
Sure. Regardless of the rights and wrongs of the long-term you know, economics of this, are you going to have to find another $5 to $7 billion in your costings in order to carry through with that promise?
No, because what the international financiers will be looking at is what the overall balance of assets and liabilities are. Those companies, while they're still on the government's books, are assets. All you're doing is transferring taking away the asset, paying off some of the liability, but in fact you're leaving the country worse off because you've lost the asset and you've lost the dividend stream. And as you so rightly said to Bill English the other day, $700 million is the loss of dividends over 10 years. That pays for the full value of what they would get from the sale of the asset, but you're left with nothing and no dividend stream. It doesn't make sense, and New Zealanders don't believe that it does make sense.
There's increasing speculation that Pharmac might be on the chop under any Trans-Pacific Partnership deal. What's Labor's view on how important Pharmac is in these trade negotiations?
Pharmac is an absolute bottom line. We should not be trading Pharmac off for a free trade agreement for the United States and the wider group. And I don't believe, actually, that there is the negotiating strength by the United States to impose that on us. It is crazy. It's not about free trade at all. It's something that the big pharmaceutical companies want. That is a bottom line. New Zealand should not be trading it away.
But did the Americans push it, though?
You're in New York. And very proud of that achievement. I am in favour of the free trade partnership that is being negotiated. But every country has bottom lines. There are things that the United States will not do. Equally, there are things that New Zealand will not do, and trading off Pharmac is one of those things. There's no philosophical justification for it. There's no requirement or precedent in terms of negotiating trade agreements.
Did the Americans bring it up with you, though, when you signed it in New York a few years back? Did the Americans bring it up as any sort of bottom line? Or?
No, they didn't bring it up as a bottom line at all. That's something that the big pharmacy companies hold as important to them. And therefore, the United States has to go through the gesture of supporting their claim. But for New Zealand, the value of Pharmac is very clear. We should not be trading it away, and I don't believe that it's a requirement of a free trade agreement to do that.
So did they bring it up at all with you?
Oh, look, from time to time, they've complained about Pharmac, they've complained about what they say is Fonterra's monopoly position, and a range of other things. Those are negotiating positions. You expect sides to take a negotiating position, but they know that they won't be getting everything they're asking for, and that's one thing they should not get.
So your R&D tax credit we talked about last week, have you worked out whether it applies to foreign companies in New Zealand?
If you look at the former tax credit and how it operates, as I advised you to do, you will have seen that it applies to New Zealand companies doing R&D in this country.
So what about foreign companies in New Zealand paying tax in New Zealand, which there are many?
No, look, it will work to the same outline as the R&D tax credit last time. You've got those documents available to you. It was a scheme that worked well. It was a scheme that Treasury opposed the government scrapping, and it's a scheme that will work well and be for New Zealand's advantage.
If there were any changes made to Pharmac under a Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, would Labor reverse those changes?
Well, it's very hard to reverse changes when you've negotiated a free trade agreement without unravelling the whole agreement. That's why a bottom line of this government, and Labor has made its viewpoint very clear, is that Pharmac should not be traded off in the interests of the free trade agreement.
Just in more broadly back to the budget, do you think that New Zealanders appear to have bought the message that the cuts to government spending had to happen in order to pay off the deficit?
What they've bought is the understanding that you can't, as this government has done in the last year, build up a deficit of $16.7 billion. That's not on. It can't be sustained. You need to have caution in your spending, but most of all, you need to grow your economy. If you don't have a growing economy, you're going to continue to have a big deficit.
So you accept that the government had to make some cuts then?
Oh, I've never doubted that there have to be cuts made in particular areas, and I've nominated a few myself, including how we'll be paying for the research and development tax credit. I'm a realist in economics. I've been a minister around the negotiating table on budgets over 15 years. I know the reality of that. But I also know this, that the key to getting out of your deficit situation is to grow your economy. There was no plan to do that.
Some trades were from Christchurch, so they haven't been paid by the EQC yet. Have you had a look at that at all?
Yeah, I think it's a real concern. If you're trying to help the economy in Christchurch, then a government department then of course should be paying its debts in promptly. That's essential for the recovery of the Christchurch economy, and I think the government needs to address that and quickly.
How should the government address that?
Oh, by putting a requirement on the Earthquake Commission to pay its bills as quickly as possible in the circumstances. This is not just about meeting normal bills in a normal time frame. This is about keeping the Christchurch economy going. And there's already considerable uncertainty with the running out of the government program of assistance for businesses, what's going to happen in Christchurch after that. And if you find that government departments and the EQC are slow in paying their bills, that obviously makes the situation harder for people already in a very difficult position.
Are you still continuing with your policy of capping the highest paid public servant at $400,000?
Oh, that's the guideline that I announced a couple of conferences ago, and that's what we'd be working to.
So, for example, the head of the Christchurch Rebuild being paid $500,000, he's been paid too much?
Well, you know, look, we would set the general guideline and lower the expectations. But I said at the time, and I'd repeat now, in exceptional circumstances, you might look at the situation. But the guideline would be that public servants ought not to be paid a higher salary rate than the Prime Minister.
Well, that takes some time to get in, though, wouldn't it? Because you'd have to need legal advice on changing contracts.
Well, you're not changing contracts in midstream, no. You're talking about recruitment.
Are you happy with the general process that the Trans-Pacific Partnership is going through? Because it seems to be clouded in a lot of secrecy, and the only way that we hear about it is through the US media.
Well, you know, we shouldn't be getting our information indirectly through somebody else's media, but the nature of a trade negotiation is that there is a degree of confidentiality around the negotiations that allows each side some space for negotiating. What I tried to do was to get a pull together a group of people, including NGOs, business, trade unions, etc., and to keep them fully briefed on what the negotiating issues were. I found that that worked very well in informing New Zealanders and the key stakeholders, and I would presume that the government should be doing that now.
Do you think they're following that process?
Well, I hope they are. It was a process that worked very well for us, and I know that our trade negotiators were comfortable with that. It has two advantages. One, it keeps your stakeholders informed, but it also allows them to feed information into the negotiating process. So it works for government and it works for the stakeholders. It's a sensible thing to do.
Does Labor standing need to further toughen dog control laws, given the two main warnings of the weekend and we've already toughened them in government?
Yeah, well, as you'll recall, we did toughen those laws. We increased the fines, we banned certain breeds, and we required the chipping of dogs. I think when you see those stories, particularly when young children are involved, you automatically have the feeling that we've got to do more to promote the safety of children around dogs. And I don't think there are easy answers on it, but you've got to look at two things. One, the various breeds of dogs and whether you want to continue to allow those breeds to remain legal in New Zealand. And the second thing is about the ownership and care by the dog owners, because sometimes aggressive dogs reflect the way in which those dogs have been handled by their owners.
To change the tack slightly, what did you think of Hilary Calvert
The eyes have it.
Promoting a brothel.
It's not the sort of thing I'd expect a parliamentarian to be doing. But that's her decision. She's a libertarian, so she's probably quite comfortable with it. But I did find it a bit odd, as I'm sure most of you did. Okay, thank you very much.